Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a graduate education flexible enough to allow you to explore what matters most to you. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What do you get when you combine two New Jersey soccer dads, a pilfering lemur, a cruise ship full of nudists, and an accidental overthrow of one of the longest-running dictatorships in contemporary Western history? How about the first 100 pages of Pulitzer Prize-winning writer Dave Barry's new novel? For this latest project, Barry teamed up with veteran comedy screenwriter and multiple Emmy Award winner Alan Zweibel, trading off chapter by chapter to tell the first-person perspective stories of pet store owner Philip Horkman and forensic plumber Jeffrey Peckerman. The result, as you might imagine, is an absurd piece of comedy where quite literally anything can happen, from our anti-heroes being pursued on terrorist allegations to their campaigns for the 2012 presidential elections. And as much fun as such a novel is to read, we get the sense that the authors had an even better time writing it. Dave Barry is here now to talk about the book, which is aptly titled Lunatics. Dave, welcome back to Think.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So I have to ask you, forensic plumber, is this something that came off the top of your head, or is there, in fact, such an occupation?
There really is such an occupation. Strange as it sounds. Thank goodness for Google. I mean, I have a feeling that there's probably no profession you could invent that if you Google it, you wouldn't find it. Somebody practiced it. But I don't think there's a ton of forensic plumbers, but they do exist. And I'm able to find one sighting of a case, and I may have this a little bit wrong, but it's pretty close to it, where a forensic plumber was able to prove that a woman who had allegedly committed suicide or drowned in her own toilet, in fact, had been murdered. And he was able to prove that she couldn't have done it to herself with that particular model of toilet. So there are forensic plumbers, and they're out there bringing justice to the people.
So this story, and that's actually a story that's reproduced in the book, that was based on fact.
Based on reality. Like, very few things in this book are, but that one is.
And I love the fact that he boasts about being one of the top two or three forensic plumbers in eastern New Jersey.
Yeah,
or whatever
he doesn't
it is.
Really have a lot to brag about, this guy. His life has not been a series of triumphs for him, and nobody likes him much, so that's about as good as it gets for him at the beginning of this book.
It has to be great fun to create a character knowing that you almost, the only sin you can commit is allowing him to do anything that makes one like him.
Right. It was much easier, I think, for me to write my character than for Alan Zweibel to write his character, because Alan's character is a lot like Alan himself. He really is.
A decent guy.
He's a nice person. He thinks positively. He doesn't think deviously, and he's never nasty. He wants to be fair. And when Alan wrote the first chapter, we hadn't really discussed what our characters would be like. But I recognized a lot of him in this, you know, this sweet person that he's a referee of a girls' soccer game. You know, even though his own kids are grown, he still likes to do it because the kind of guy he is. And so when it was my turn to write the second chapter, and my character had to respond to that character, I came up with the most horrible person I could imagine. Just nothing is good about him. He's a coward. He's a racist, homophobe. He's just a sleazeball. And it's much more fun to write that way, I thought.
So had you agreed ahead of time anything about the characters that you would write, besides maybe even, did you give each other the names that you had?
I think I named them, and it was one of those things where I was just sort of looking for placeholder names.
Uh-huh.
Just invented two names, really. But the way things work with books is, with novels, is if something just seems right, you tend to believe it after a minute or two. And so then, you know, that becomes your guy, and you can't imagine him having a different name. But we didn't really agree on anything ahead of time. He, I don't think, gave his guy a name. I gave his guy the name in the second chapter. And we didn't certainly know where it was going. I mean, the premise was just, as Alan had come up with it, that there are two dads at a soccer game, and one of them is a ref and one of them is a parent. And the ref calls an offsides call on the daughter of the other guy. And they don't, you know, they get into an argument, but that neither one of them expects it to go beyond that. They don't know each other and they don't like each other. So they figure that's it. They're not, you know, they're never going to see each other again. That was all we had in the way of a premise for this book.
Did you have any rules like, okay, I will write this and you can't change anything? Almost like it almost feels like improv in some ways.
Ended up calling it improvisational novel writing. We sort of followed the rules of improvisational comedy. I've never done that. Alan has. But the rule is, I think they say yes and. In other words, whatever the other person says, you don't contradict it, you don't mock it, you don't say that's stupid. You take it and go with it. And then you can add whatever you want. And then when you hand it back, the other person has to go yes and to you. So we had this agreement. We would just take what the other guy wrote. And the other rule we had was we called it steering, no steering. In other words, I would write a chapter, and sometimes I would think, now I know where I think this should go. Mm-hmm. I know what his guy should now do. But I wasn't allowed to tell him. and every now and then he would do it, but more often than not, he wouldn't. He would do something else, sometimes something completely unexpected. I think there was an element of revenge in the writing of the book. Like, all right, I see where you left me. Look where I'm going to leave you.
Yeah, it feels like that sometimes. It's like, well, top that, buddy.
Yeah, like... at some point, they're on a cruise ship, and the last thing he reveals to me is that they're naked. Everybody in the cruise ship is naked, which he hadn't mentioned up to that point.
So you introduce a naked nun.
Yeah, well, Alan actually introduced the naked nun,
That's right. She becomes your love interest.
No, she is his love interest.
Oh, forgive me. Yeah,
anybody could be my guy's love interest. He's a horn dog basically. Mm-hmm. But Alan is very faithful and loving and caring, and it bothers him greatly when he meets this beautiful woman. We should explain to the listeners that at this point, it's fairly early on in the book, these guys have gotten into an argument at a soccer game, and they end up, through a series of coincidences, getting stuck back together again and ultimately end up in a police chase that leads to them being mistakenly pursued as terrorists. And within less than 100 pages, they have accidentally, totally not intending to do this, hijacked a clothing-optional cruise ship. On that cruise ship, Alan's guy, Horkman, is trying to blend in, and he meets this woman in a flower-arranging class. And she's lovely. I assume she's physically lovely, but he's a spiritual man, and they have a wonderful conversation. And at the end, she reveals to him that she's, in fact, a nun. which only intrigues him more because he's a huge fan of The Sound of Music.
Well, and he's got this great line where she says something like, well, have you never done this before? And, of course, I think she's referring to the fact like
the clothing
that he's on. Right. And he's like, no, I've never taken a flower arranging cruise before or class before.
Yeah.
So you have written with co-authors before, particularly in the novels that you've written for children. And by the way, there's a nice disclosure at the front of this, that this is not one of those books.
Yeah, let's get that out there.
My kids, who are big fans, were disappointed, but I made sure
that
they didn't pick it up.
Don't let your children read this book.
Yeah. But how is it different when you're writing with someone and you are doing that sort of daily back and forth and those decisions together about what's going to happen?
Well, with Ridley Pearson, with whom I wrote the series of books, they're called the Starcatchers books. The first one's called Peter and the Starcatchers. And they're prequels to Peter Pan. They sort of tell the story, our version of a story of how an ordinary boy can end up with the ability to fly and on an island with the pirate and mermaids and so on. And we ended up writing five books in that series. We didn't intend to. We really thought we were going to write one little book on how Peter Pan came to be, and we ended up writing this five-part series for Disney, and it's actually done wonderfully well, and it's in this April 15th, it's going to be opening as a Broadway play, Peter and the Starcatcher. So that's been very cool. But the way we did those books was very different from the way Alan and I did this book. In the Starcatcher's books, they're very plot-driven, and you need that with kids. I mean, kids want a story, and they want the story to make sense. So we sat down for weeks ahead of time and hammered out every scene. We knew all the characters, we knew the scenes, we knew the rationales for what they were doing, before we wrote anything.
Mm-hmm.
And when we wrote it, we would, I would take some chapters. We did it by characters, not just alternating chapters. And then we would send our chapters back and forth to each other. And there was plenty of steering, and you were allowed to, you know, we argued and worked out how we wanted it to go. And with Alan, as I said, it was completely improvisational, so you didn't change the other guy's stuff. You didn't tell him what to do. We didn't worry as much about plot, which is pretty obvious. I mean, it's got a plot, but it's an insane plot.
And you kind of don't miss, I mean, after you let go of expecting any of it to make sense.
Exactly. Early on, you have to say, okay,
here's what
they're
we're
not
doing.
Going to be. This is not a work of gritty realism. Once you accept that, then, yeah, it just becomes, well, what else can they think of to have these guys do? Because, as you say, we end up having them becoming very involved in the presidential election in the United States after they've gone to Cuba, to Somalia, to Yemen, and to China, where they've, in each case, accomplished amazing, internationally significant things, all by mistake. They never know, ever in this book, which is the one thing we tried to be consistent about. These two guys, there's two things that they always hate each other. They never get along throughout the entire course of the book. They wish they could be apart, but they can't. They keep getting driven back together. And the other thing is they keep doing amazing things, but they don't know it. They don't do it on purpose, and they never realize that they've done it, which is why about, I'd say, halfway through the book, we start introducing as a main character Peter Jennings, who comes on as a nightly news and explains to the readers how the world is perceiving what's been going on, because all you've been seeing so far is what these two lunatics have been perceiving.
Far be it for me to correct you, but it's Brian Williams that you're talking about.
Excuse me, Brian Williams. I don't know what I... Yeah, Peter Jennings retired, didn't he?
He died.
Yeah. Yes, and I hate to be the one to inform that. Well, yeah, but you're right.
Well, let me ask you this, because, I mean, this is not a... It's not a political book exactly, but there is some political humor in here, some very topical stuff. Did you actually have to go and research, even to a small extent, places like Yemen and China?
A small extent. Here again, without giving away too much of the plot, we have them do things that you probably couldn't do in reality, but we had to come up with it. Just just plausible enough for the reader, you know, who's enjoying the ride to go along with. Yeah, we did some research, but I would say 90% of it consisted of Wikipedia.
You know, Dave, people talk so often about writing being ultimately a pretty lonely profession. Is that why, do you think, that you crave occasionally working with someone else in a pretty intense way?
Yeah, it's weird. I've ended up doing it now a bunch with Ridley and then now with Alan Zweibel, and I've really enjoyed it. I think in the end, it's probably more satisfying when you write your own book completely all the way through. And I think in the end, I still enjoy that the most. But just as sort of a fun exercise, I've really enjoyed this, both with Alan and with Ridley. And with Ridley, those books for kids, that was really all Ridley's idea originally. And I never would have thought of writing books for kids. I used to mock people who say, you know, everybody ends up writing a book for kids. I'm not going to be one of them. But it's been fun just because kids make unbelievable readers.
And there's a lot of humor in those books, too.
Yeah, you can't be as, you can't go as far with the humor, I don't think, with kids' books. But you can, yeah, kids like humor.
Dave Barry is with us. He's a novelist and Pulitzer Prize-winning former syndicated columnist. We're talking this hour about his new book, co-authored by Alan Zweibel, Lunatics. We'll be back to the conversation in a moment. If you'd like to join us, we have phones open at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Pulitzer Prize winner Dave Barry. His new novel, co-authored by Alan Zweibel, is called Lunatics. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. I'm curious, Dave, because you make it look and sound so easy, when you're writing and you're sort of in your space, how much do you sweat over a turn of phrase or the right word or the right name that absolutely works in a particular sentence?
A lot. I'm a very slow writer. Mm-hmm. And I'm one of those people who can't write a draft and say, I'm going to come back to that later. I like it when I'm done with the sentence that it's the way I think it should be.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm very, very slow. It's like agonizingly slow.
And what does it take to keep perspective on what's funny? If you've been working, you know, laboring over the same paragraph for half an hour, is it just practice that allows you to still recognize when it's working and when it's not?
Yeah, and faith. But I'll tell you, the longer you work on a joke, you know, even if it turns out to be great, you know, 5 years later you look back and go, oh, yeah, that's pretty funny. When you're actually doing it, the longer you spend on it, the more likely you are to think it's not only not a joke, but it's really the saddest thing. It shouldn't even be shown to people for fear that they'll want to kill themselves from the depression they'll be feeling as a result of reading it. So you really have to be trusting your, you know, the fact that at some point at the beginning of that process, you saw some humor there, and that, you know, even though you have now basically analyzed every possible way of telling that same joke, and every possible word you could use. Should you use weasel or should you use badger? Which word would be funnier? Where should you put it exactly? You've gone through every permutation of that, so you can't possibly see any, you know, it can't strike you at all as funny that you thought it was at one point. And if you execute it right, it will be. You have to pray for that.
So, is it easy for you to turn that off at the end of the writing day?
I'm pretty good at it. My wife, Michelle Kaufman, is a sports writer, so we both work all day in the same office. We're both writing all day, and we both always have assignments.
Mm-hmm. So
we have deadlines. She's got more than I do, but we both have them. And she's always saying to me, you know, that she envies it. I'll stop. At some point, I'll just stop, and then I really don't think about it too much. I'll go watch mindless television, if that's not redundant, or just, you know, play the guitar or whatever, but I can pretty much set it aside, and usually I can go to sleep pretty easily, something that she cannot do.
You're in a band, is that right, with a bunch of other writers, the Rock Bottom Remainders?
The word band might be a little bit strong.
I'm in a clump of musicians.
Musicians is, again, a term I don't know that I would be banding about. But I'm in a group of authors. We're called the Rock Bottom Remainders, and we were founded 20 years ago. We've been around 20 years now, longer than, you know, your Beatles, for example, to name another band. And the original idea was, would it be great if you got a group of authors with musical skill and had them perform rock songs and raise money for good causes like literacy causes?
Mm-hmm.
The flaw in that thinking was that turned out we didn't have any musical talent, or not very much anyway. But that didn't stop us, because we really all had fun. We became friends. Amy Tan is a member of the band, and she put it very clearly, I think, after one of our first performances. She said, I would do this to kill the whales. And although we, to my knowledge, have never killed a whale, we've played a lot of shows, and we're still hanging in there.
You've played with Springsteen.
We played with Bruce Springsteen in Los Angeles, and it was, I guess I'm one of the few people who can say this, but he came on stage. He knew somebody who knew somebody. It was one of those things, and it was a bookseller's convention. They didn't believe it was really Bruce Springsteen, and I don't blame them for not believing it. But he came out, and we only had one song left, which was Gloria.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a very easy song. What I say is, if you take a guitar and throw it on the ground, it will play Gloria. That's how easy Gloria is. And I had to ask Bruce Springsteen, you know, Bruce, do you know Gloria? And he said, I think I can handle it. So anyway, he played my guitar, but I sang lead on that song, and we shared a microphone, and I'll never forget. So I would go, Gloria, and Bruce Springsteen would go, Gloria. See, he was singing back up to me. Not many people, I don't think. can make that claim.
Have you ever thought about writing? Do you write original songs, or is it mostly covers?
We do a couple of original songs. There's a song that I wrote that we do called Proofreading Woman, mm-hmm. which is I think the only song, love song ever written to a proofreading woman. And the chorus goes, she never says between you and I.
Well, I guess, you know, if you're a writer, you learn to really value someone who can look at your copy and say it works or it doesn't work.
Well, I wrote that song for Garrison Keillor, believe it or not. Mm-hmm. I was on his show this years ago, a Prairie Home Companion, I guess, and he said, we're doing a song about the book business. The whole show is about the book business, so I'd like you to write a song about somebody in the book business. And I was just trying to think, like, well, who has never been... You know, I never been praised in a song. I thought proofreaders.
So I have to ask, in the last book...
Wait, I just wanted to add, I forgot. I also wrote a song called The Tupperware Blues.
And what's that about?
It's about Tupperware. It's a blues song about Tupperware. It's, as far as I know, the only blues song ever written about Tupperware. And I did perform it at a Tupperware sales convention once, several thousand people, and got a standing ovation. For it. Also, they gave a standing ovation to everybody else on the stage and ovenware and everything, but still, I got one.
Is there burping in the song?
There is. Don't forget to burp the lid to make the seal secure. It's one of the lines, although I later found out that they don't like you to use the term burp.
Oh, not anymore?
I don't think so. I don't think that's approved by the Tupperware people. Well, things could have changed. I don't know. This was a while back.
It's hard to believe they still make Tupperware.
They are. I think they do quite well. Mm-hmm. And if you're ever in... Kissimmee, Florida, you can visit Tupperware World Headquarters and visit the Museum of Historic Food Containers. This is true. Just a little fact I'm tossing out here.
Dave Barry is my guest for talking about his entire career, but also about his new book co-authored by Alan Zweibel. It's called Lunatics. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. We have an email here from Katie, who asks, do you find there is more absurdity in our present times? And if so, does that make it easier to be funny?
I don't know. It always seems to me that whatever time you're living in seems crazy. Mm-hmm. Bear in mind, I went to college in the 60s. So if I look back at that, I think, you know, to me, sometimes if I try to be rational about it, the times we live in now seem very calm.
Yeah.
It's sane and normal compared with the 60s. But, you know, I think that's the thing about humor. There's always, always an infinite supply of material out there. And, you know, it tends to peak during presidential election years. Political humor does. So this is the right period, and it will continue to be, I think, right up to the election. But, and, you know, I think it's there's always lots of fodder. It's just a matter of looking at stuff. Most of my career... most of the humor I've written really hasn't been about political stuff or issues. It's been more about, you know, stuff that I thought was funny that was going on, my dogs or something like that. Just because when I wrote a weekly humor column, it would run several weeks after I wrote it usually because it ran in Sunday magazines and so on. Mm-hmm. Which meant that anything I wrote wasn't going to be seen for another month or so. So I tended to avoid anything that was really very topical.
Yeah.
Now, because of the internet and because of all the TV shows, I mean, you know, Letterman and Jon Stewart and Jay Leno and all these, you know, Conan O'Brien, all these guys doing jokes every single day, every single night, and then a billion people on Twitter doing jokes. Anything that is current is going to have a zillion jokes written about it within hours. So I don't really know what question I'm answering anymore.
Well,
but I tend to look for more kind of, you know, I don't know, maybe a little quirkier, a little more close to home humor.
In some ways it makes sense because, I mean, people, you know, you have a very broad audience if you speak about things that are pretty personal.
Yeah, and people, I think, laugh the hardest not at things that seem really strange and weird to them. People will laugh at things that are really strange and weird. That's always a good source of humor. But when they really laugh the hardest is when you tell them something that they think is true of them.
Hmm.
They go, oh my God, that's absolutely the way I think about that. Or, I just never thought to say it that way, or would never have admitted it out loud. But comedians who get you to get that reaction, I think, get the biggest laughs.
In your last book of essays, was that I'll Mature When I'm Dead?
I'll Mature When I'm Dead.
Yeah. There was a piece that we played on a family car trip through the desert, the section where you do kind of a send-up of the Twilight books.
Oh, yeah. Now, thank you. I loved writing that.
Mm-hmm.
That was one of the most fun things, and I was really proud of it. I don't know that it got that much attention, because I think that the audience I was aiming at with that, it was a parody of the Twilight novels, and you know, God bless her, that woman made a ton of money, and she found her market, and she served that market well. But I just thought those books were hilarious, unintentionally hilarious. So I'm writing this parody that I think is brilliant, but then I realized after the book came out that the people who love the books will never read the parody, and the people who read the parody in my book probably will never read the Twilight book.
Mm-hmm.
But I just thought it was such a wonderfully hilarious premise. I mean, right from the start, that here you have, and I still think it's very funny. I don't know why more people don't think it's funny. But the premise is, here you have these vampires, and they are incredibly sophisticated, brilliant, accomplished people. They're all gorgeous, physically gorgeous. They have money, and they could live anywhere in the world, live any way they want. What do they choose to do? Become high school students in Oregon. No, they don't. That's the silliest thing I ever heard. And then, you know, he falls in love with this girl who is just the most painfully unlikable person in the history of protagonists. I don't know. I just found it. And then the woman they got to play her in the movies, have you ever seen her smile? She seems to be in a permanent state of, like, intestinal discomfort.
Well, she's laughing all the way to the bank.
I guess.
I agree.
Yeah, anyway. So anyway, thank you. I'm glad you just brought that up, because I loved writing that parody, and I've always liked it.
Yeah, we actually quote it a lot in our house, because the other thing that you do is really capture the language, which is often very redundant. I should say I have middle school students, which is how they knew the work and laughed like crazy. But things like, I closed my eyes so that I wouldn't be able to see, or to, you know, there's just a lot of ridiculous
very
language.
Obviously. And the other thing that she does in this book that I focused on is, there's an old thing about writing. Here's a little tip. If anybody out there is writing a book, we're just like a tip. If you want to say somebody said something, say that person said it.
Mm-hmm.
Very rarely do you use any verb other than said, because it just slows everything down. You know, if you look at any great writer, especially somebody like Elmore Leonard, you will not see any word other than said ever used.
None of this exclaimed or uttered.
In the Twilight book, it's like there's a thesaurus, the world's biggest thesaurus of all the different ways you can say said. So he never, ever says anybody said anything. It's always expressed, you know, exclaimed. Anyway.
Yeah, it's almost like a high school teacher told her never to say said, because it's too boring.
Right. Well, it's people believe that the way to make their writing vary is to say the same thing with different words, which is not really good advice. Think of something new to say and feel free to use the same old words.
I would have imagined this, Dave, and then I read your website, and now I guess it's confirmed for me that the thing every aspiring American writer wants more than anything is for you to read their work.
Yeah, I believe, and this is, I think, true of everybody who writes, but if you are a humor writer, you're going to get a lot of humor submitted to you by people who want you to make them famous.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm never clear on what exactly the process is.
But
what I get is letters saying, you know, I'm sure that at some point when you were starting out, somebody came along and helped you. And I always think, no, nobody did that. I helped myself. I wrote and wrote and wrote and sent it off, and got rejected many times, and then finally got a few people to accept it, and I kept writing. But, you know, that's the way you do it. But there are very few shortcuts to becoming a successful writer. You know, you generally go through a lot of rejection, and you don't make a lot of money at the beginning, if at all. And you have to just keep, you know, working and honing your craft until you find the right market, the right whatever for what you do, or accept that it's just not going to work.
Mm-hmm.
But what's not going to happen is that you're going to have this great talent that nobody ever noticed, and if one person comes along and just discovers you, you will become suddenly a successful published author. You know, there's a system, you know, there are agents, there are editors, you know, I guess some every now and then somebody gets overlooked, but you know, it's hard to get published. It takes a long time, takes a lot of patience and a lot of work. But if you really are pretty good at it, a good writer, eventually you'll get published and you'll get recognized at some level. And I've never come up with a simple, short way to explain this to people when they send me their humor. I don't, you know, critique humor. I'm not an editor. I'm not an agent. So I try to get that across, and I say, here's what I did. Here are some resources that might be able to help you, places where, you know, authors who haven't been published learn how to do it. But you know, other than that, it's really there's not much of a sure thing, and it usually takes a lot of patience and time, which is not what people want to hear, but it's true.
Yeah, the discovered overnight is much more fun.
Yeah, and I don't know what field you get discovered overnight. Maybe, you know, I don't know enough about music. Maybe in music you could. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Maybe if you're a really, really, spectacular-looking person, you could get discovered as a model or something overnight. But most careers, you know, I think nobody gets discovered. Nothing happens to most people that quickly. There's always a story behind it.
And who's ready for being discovered overnight? You know, whether you're a writer or whatever you want to do, you have to have been practicing for a long time.
Yeah, and like last night, I don't know if you watched the Grammys, but...
I couldn't bear it.
Well, Adele. I like that woman. You know, she gets up there, and she's a really good singer and songwriter, mm-hmm. but she spent a long time getting to where she got, you know, and now she's really famous. She's Adele. And I just discovered her like 3 days ago because my daughter likes her music. But I'm kind of reassured to see, oh, she's obviously been around a long time and paid a lot of dues and put a lot of effort into it. And that's how you get where she is. But, you know, these contests, these American Idol and stuff, sort of promote the idea that the way to get famous is to go and suddenly be discovered.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to pay any dues, you don't have to do anything else. You just go on this TV show, and because you're so brilliant and wonderful and great, you're going to be discovered and you'll be famous. And that's just so not the way it's going to work. It probably kills a lot of people who are really good singers who have worked at the craft for all their lives to see those shows sort of. But then, the problem is that then it creates the idea in every lousy singer in America, every karaoke singer, that they could become famous and great.
Dave Barry is my guest. His newest novel is called Lunatics.
What are we even talking about now?
I don't know. We're talking about your life as a whole, and we will talk more about it in about 2.5 minutes. If you'd like to join this conversation, call in to 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is novelist and essayist Dave Barry. His new novel, co-authored by Alan Zweibel, is called Lunatics. I do have to say, Dave, that Lunatics has perhaps the best epilogue I have ever had the pleasure to read at the end of a novel. Was it apparent when you guys were done and you thought, okay, this thing is done, that you wanted something else?
Yes, because as we've discussed earlier, what we loosely call the plot tends to go all over the place, and we thought there's a lot of loose ends here. We need to find out. Tell the reader what happened. So we thought of stories for each of the various characters, including Buddy the Lemur and Charo and Donald Trump and Chuck E. Cheese, various characters that appear in the book. And we wrote that epilogue. And what we've done on the book tour is sometimes just read, you know, if they want you to read from the book, we just read the epilogue. Here's what happens to everybody at the end.
You know, it's ideal because it really doesn't...
If you want to know why these people are doing this book, you'll have to read the book.
It doesn't give anything away, but it does sort of draw you in.
Yeah.
Donald Trump, is he like a gift to humor writers everywhere?
I've always found Donald Trump to be wonderfully amusing. And just lately when he's been, you know, acknowledging that maybe he'd be willing to run for president in the United States, which would be such a gracious thing for him to do and, you know, to take time from his busy schedule, to take time to take away from his TV show.
Yeah, the reality show.
Hugely mm-hmm. successful, by the way, if you don't know. Hugely successful. To run for president of the United States. What a man, what an American, what a patriot.
You, am I correct about this? You actually started your writing career in hard news journalism.
Yeah, when I got out of college, I was an English major and I liked to write, mm-hmm. but I didn't have any ambitions really, except for that it would be nice to get a job where you could write. And I got a job at a newspaper in Pennsylvania called the Daily Local News in Westchester, Pennsylvania, and it was a 30,000 circulation daily newspaper. Where that back in those days, the early 70s, they would hire you without any real experience because they didn't pay very much. but I loved it. And I was a regular reporter. I mean, I did everything you do at a small newspaper. I covered fires, you know, went to the police station and read the police blotter, wrote obituaries, school board meetings. I covered municipal meetings, some of which I'm sure are still going on. I mean, unbelievably boring. You know, wrote about sewage and zoning and things I knew absolutely nothing about, which is the essence of journalism, to be able to write authoritatively about a subject you know nothing about.
It's good training, though, in that discipline of getting work done always on deadline.
It was the best training. All of it was. The best way to learn journalism is to do it. And that was, we did everything there. Including covering sports and stuff. So, it really enabled me to be a better columnist because by the time I was writing columns, I was very familiar with the conventions of how newspapers work and how they write and what they say and how they appear to be authoritative, and all the cliches that routinely get used in journalism. When I became a humor column, I can make fun of all of that quite authoritatively because I'd done all that, and I can mock the way editors think because I've been an editor, and also just the skill of learning, to write a story so that it's accurate. It's useful to be, if you're a humor writer, to be an accurate humor writer. Even that way, when you're wrong on, you could be wrong on purpose. You know you're being wrong. Hmm.
Do you remember the last hard news piece you wrote?
Oh, man. No, I don't. Probably some fire or something.
Yeah.
But it would have been a long, long ago, decades and decades ago. I have written some sort of serious essays for as a journalist over the years since then, but no actual news coverage.
Do you have any taste for that now? Like, is there part of you that intellectually that sort of likes to exercise the non-funny side of yourself?
No. I mean, what I always say is there are so many people writing serious things. Mm-hmm. There are so many people writing serious essays who have strong opinions. And I have some strong opinions, but I just don't think that's my job. That's not.
Yeah.
There's enough of that.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the phones now. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Tim on the line in Richardson. Hey, Tim.
Hey, I have to say the Daily Local News is one of the most banal titles for a newspaper I've ever heard.
I know. Doesn't it sound like the newspaper that Superman delivered as a boy.
Exactly. It's funny because when I called, you veered off in the conversation exactly to the question I was going to ask, which is I was aware, greatly admire Mr. Barry's work and find him real funny, and I was wondering if he had any thoughts, sad as they might be, on possibly the future of newspapers, since that's actually where he started out.
I'm pretty pessimistic about that. I would like to say, oh, we're going to work this out because there's always going to be a demand for news and people want news, so we'll figure out how this is going to work. But I think we have greatly in the business. The horror is we are in a business that is run by English majors, which is a scary thing.
They're very sincere, and they love language.
We've managed to get everything wrong we could possibly get wrong with the age of the internet. Newspapers have, and they're suffering. They're in bad shape, and I think the problem is the discussion I have with my wife a lot. We even argue about it. Is I think we greatly overestimated during the heyday of the 50s, 60s. 70s of American newspapers when they were just making tons of money. We greatly overestimated the thirst on the part of the readership for what we were giving them. Hmm. The reason we were making tons of money is we were an advertising vehicle and the only one. And it was a time of, you know, prosperity, and advertisers paid a lot of money to be in the newspaper because people bought the newspaper. We thought people were buying the newspaper because they wanted to read this, you know, what we were giving them. And now that people can choose what they read by means of the internet and Twitter and Facebook and so on, it's turning out they were not as fascinated as what we thought was important as they were fascinated with what we thought important as we thought they were. So we're finding that, you know, newspapers are finding that fewer and fewer people, especially young people, want to read them, and nobody seems to want to pay for them anymore. And I'd like to say that there's going to be a solution, that somebody's going to figure it all out. I thought for a while the solution would be that Google would just buy us all and we would become the content providers for them. But I don't think that's going to happen now. I don't know what's going to happen. But meanwhile, journalism's strong. Newspapers are gone. I believe that firmly. They're gone. The question now is, will somebody save journalism? Mm-hmm. And I don't know the answer to that. I hate to give a depressing answer, but that's what I think.
Well, I always wonder, you know, the medium of a paper hard copy may be gone, but I don't know. I mean, do you think no one wants daily local news anymore?
They do, but they kind of want it without paying for it.
Yeah.
But nobody
wants to work for free.
Yeah, it's And you know, even if they still want the local news, I'm not sure where they're going to get, investigative journalism by really skilled, you know, journalists. I don't know where that's going to come from, and you know, who's going to, it seems we're getting less and less objective, high quality journalism because there's less and less market for it.
Hmm. It's also really hard to be a star if you're just a sort of investigative journalist looking into, you know, piles and piles of papers that may not be very sexy in the end, but is important.
Yeah, and I think people are, you know, and I can totally understand this. People want to write their own version of the news, and with the internet, you can, you know, mm-hmm. you can do that. And if you get enough people to read what you're writing, you can become a big deal, become authoritative, without really necessarily doing any research. It's a little scary sometimes.
So a lot of people were devastated, Dave, years ago when you said, I'm not going to do the regular column anymore. Have you ever looked back and thought, bad decision, or have you just been thrilled ever since?
I've never regretted the decision. I still write humor. I mean, at the end of every year, I write a big, huge, gigantic, painfully long year in review, which I hope is funny, and I write a gift guide, and I write columns through the year occasionally. Like this year, I'll go to the Olympics and write every day from London, and then I'll go to both political conventions and mm-hmm. write every day from those. So I'll end up writing, you know, probably a few dozen columns this year. That's fine for me, though. I don't really want to go back to writing every week. And people have been really great. I mean, a lot of people have said, I miss that. Why don't you do that again? And I appreciate that. It's just I did that a long, long time. And just felt, okay, I don't want to keep doing that until I hate doing it. So I said I'll do other things that are more interesting to me right now.
Do you feel compelled to write every day, or do you have to sort of some days drag yourself in there and sit down regardless of how you feel?
Well, especially now, but I have some deadlines. I do feel compelled to write every day, but I always have. Mm-hmm. I think most people who write, even if it's a half an hour, I don't know why that is. I guess it's the fear that if you stop, then you'll forget how to do it or something. But yeah, I write pretty much every day, at least a little bit.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We have an email here from Madeline who writes, your book sounds like the literary equivalent of that wonderful movie, The In-Laws, with Peter Falk and Alan Arkin.
That's a very apt and perceptive comment. In fact, there is a movie deal for this book. It was optioned by Universal, and Steve Carell is the word is attached.
He's playing the sweet guy.
He's going to be the nice guy. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's the good guy. And when we've been in these conversations, Alan Swibella and I have been in these conversations with folks in L.A., where you talk about, well, how do you see the movie? What will it be like, and so on? That comes up, The In-Laws, a lot as sort of the prototype of that kind of book, where two people who don't get along at all are thrust together in comic circumstances in a situation much bigger than they realize. So that, and the other one that sometimes comes up is Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, John Candy and Steve Martin.
Oh, sure, yeah. What is your media diet like?
I read the Miami Herald.
Despite the fact that newspapers are dead and dying?
I read it in paper form. Every day I read the Miami Herald, and every day the New York Times, which you can get here in Miami, delivered. I read the Wall Street Journal, because my son is a reporter there. I don't know how this happened, but he's an investigative reporter, and he deals in fact. He works up there.
Do you feel like he's rebelled against you?
Yeah. And then online, you know, I skim through Washington Post and L.A. Times and Chicago, various papers, lots of blogs. I try to read both sides blogs. I'm basically a libertarian, so I kind of like that, you know. Any blog that makes fun of the federal government, I find entertaining.
You and a lot of other people.
And like that. And very random at times. That's the thing about the Internet. I'm always saying, like, thanks to the Internet, I'm wasting time faster than ever before. You start out with one site you're used to, and you end up with 50 links later, you're looking at, you know, fruit flies, the flies of the Ryukyu Islands.
And you want to believe it's making you better and smarter,
yeah,
don't you?
It's like, how did I get here? What was I doing originally?
Do you write a lot of personal correspondence? I know you have some grown kids, but you have a daughter at home. Do you write letters and things like that?
No, not much. I mean, I email people, and not that many people. Mm-hmm. I'm a fairly solitary person. My entire social life mainly consists of my wife, who is, like, she's Cuban and Jewish. Mm-hmm. So between those, she's Cuban, they call them Jubans. So between those two things, she is connected somehow to pretty much everybody in the southeastern United States and Latin America. And so she has many, many friends. So I figure one of us has to be, some solitary time. So that's me.
Are you shyer than people expect you to be?
I'm much shyer than people. I'm happy to be alone. I'm not easy in company of people I don't know particularly well. I mean, I'm not like, I don't think terrified of it. It's just, that's not what I seek. I don't seek that out.
Yeah.
That's my dog barking. I'm very close with my dog.
Well, that's good. So you're not shy in front of the dog.
Lucy and I, we get along. I talk to her probably as much as anybody else.
There's a lot of pressure on you. Isn't there in a group of strangers, doesn't everybody look to you to say something hilarious?
Yes. Over the years, I've learned to deal with that phenomenon. Mm-hmm. When I was new to it, when I had just sort of achieved some notice as a columnist and people who knew me only that way, I used to be sort of surprised at the way they look at me as if they're expecting me to make jokes. And not only that, I find that no matter what I said, even if it was something really inane, they would laugh if it were really clever. But now I'm kind of used to that. I just had to learn. I don't have to be entertaining to everybody all the time. I mean, I think I'm reasonably funny and okay in conversation, but I don't feel like I have to be a stand-up comic for everybody I talk to.
Dave Barry's new novel, co-authored by Alan Zweibel, is called Lunatics. Dave, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for giving us the hour.
Thanks for having me on. I enjoyed it.
Today's show was engineered by Justin Martin. Joe Bellotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about the show, find out about upcoming programs, and download the podcast at kera.org/think. I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.